134 lectures on enseignant philosophy. Plied with a strictly impersonal attitude, for the instant the mind is personally involved in its problem, the sense of true perspective and relationship is lost. Most people sit in one end of the scales when they weigh a problem. We are prone to live not according to our knowledge of right and wrong but according to our prejudices and whims. Things have an unpleasant way of looking not as they actually are but as we want them to, all because we cannot divorce the personal equation from our problem. Thus we make the decision fit our own desire and try to resolve the universe into a facsimile of our own notions. Many people who would scorn to be dishonest in the physical sense are dishonest mentally. The one who possesses true discrimination realizes only too well that he can never be just while he is personally involved in the question on which he must pass judgment. A slight digression may not be out of order for the purpose of considering two terms which modern psychology has popularized, namely, the inferiority and superiority complexes. In reality, these two types are each twofold in character. The inferiority complex is that mental attitude which causes the individual to picture himself as a groveling, squirming worm of the dust, predestined to be blind, to live in darkness, and eternally to be trodden underfoot. This attitude paralyzes initiative and is a never-ending blasphemy against the divinity innate in every creature. The inferiority-superiority complex is the index of the hope less egotist. Its victims have full confidence in their own integrity and excellence and in every act evince the realization of their self-importance. They make themselves heartily obnoxious, however, by assuming airs of modesty and inferiority in order to adduce evidence that they are not what they know they are. They have heard that great people are invariably distinguished by their modesty, hence their assumption of the virtue. The superiority-superiority complex manifests itself as bound less self-assurance. Such an individual, like the character of the storybook, can achieve the impossible, do the undoable. The Disciplines of Salvation 135. And unscrew the inscrutable. The pages of history teem with the exploits of these colossal egotists who, however, back their egotism up with achievement. Such achievements, though, are almost invariably of a temporal nature. Several philosophers also exhibited this moral obliquity, but are remembered chiefly for more worthy accomplishments. The superiority-inferiority complex is usually borne by an individual who is an inveterate but unconscious liar. Such a person gives an external exhibition of consummate nerve while internally recognizing himself unable to cope with the situation. In other words, he is the high-pressure blufferer, the personality plus product of modern pseudo-psychology. If it were possible for such a person to be honest with himself but for a single instant, his courage would ooze out like a cold sweat and leave him a moral bankrupt. Discrimination is not only the ability to choose wisely from the mass of mental and physical phenomena around us, but is also the ability to analyze the elements of our own thinking, feeling, and acting for the purpose of unfolding that which is good and eliminating that which is unnecessary. A very good way to approach this particular problem is to make an inventory of our assets and liabilities, mental, emotional, and physical. While so engaged, we might choose as our motto, "What is man that the Lord should be mindful of him?" What do we know that our opinions should be of vast pith and ammo? Meant. By what right do we sit in judgment upon the world and its maker? During such self-examination, we are lost without honesty or, more correctly, integrity. It is well that we differentiate between honesty and integrity. Honesty gives 16 ounces to the pound because of law, while integrity gives 16 ounces to the pound because 16 ounces make a pound. Having decided to judge yourself with absolute integrity, make a list of the virtues you possess, together with the degree of their opposites which manifest in your nature. If you are kind, to what degree are you unkind? If you are generous, to what degree are you penurious? If you are just, to what degree are you unjust? Perfections are determined by the degree of imperfections. Thus truthfulness is determined by the degree of untruthfulness. This is doubtless the reason one is so prone to see faults in others, for faults are the basis upon which the degree of faultlessness is to be estimated. Possibly, for the same reason, few people are congratulated for their virtues with either the fervor or the frequency that they are criticized for their vices. Having arrived at a reasonable estimate of the proportions of ignorance intervening between your present state and the desired state, next list the arts, sciences, and crafts with whose principles you have some degree of familiarity. Then ask yourself what is the percentage of your understanding of them as compared to that which is knowable concerning them. Discrimination will assist you to judge accurately the relation occupied by what you know to that which can be known. It logically follows also that your capacity to understand is measured by that which you understand, and by the understanding with which you understand you are most likely to be understood. Since it reveals man's incompleteness, discrimination is there for a continual urge toward completion. Man is not perfect until he knows all and is united in consciousness with all. Until this state is reached, there can be no cessation of activity without disaster. We all have mental faculties that are weak, sense perceptions uncertain in the quality of their acuteness. Discrimination assists us to develop rationality by balancing the faculties until all the parts involved in the process of knowing are equilibrated. The result is a balanced and rational attitude toward the various conditions of life. Discrimination inspires tolerance in that it reveals the relationship which man as a spiritual condition bears to the body which he occupies. Discrimination proves that while the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak. Criticism should therefore be directed against these inconsistencies existing in the relationship of the parts. In this way, the sting of personality is removed. The spirit of man is ever composing beautiful melodies, but by the time they reach physical expression, they are mostly 136 lectures on Ancient Philosophy. THE Disciplines of Salvation 137. Reduced to discords. Such was the dilemma of the young man learning to play the cornet, who, turning to his teacher, exclaimed, "Why is it that when I blow the music in it is so sweet, but when it comes out it is so sour?" Discrimination helps man to recognize the melodies of the spirit and ignore the inharmonies of the flesh. Hence, discrimination is a forgiving faculty, not in the general acceptation of the word but in the sense of understanding, for the moment we fully understand people we have forgiven them. Spirit is intrinsically beautiful, and those who raise their consciousness to the recognition of universal life dwell in the sense of beauty. Discrimination reveals the beautiful in that it chooses to gaze upon the face of reality and to ignore the seething ocean of illusion. The realization of self is synonymous with the recognition of divinity, and he who beholds with his inner perception the radiant face of the One has reached the vanishing point of enmity and animosity. Discrimination also dispels the illusion of relationships. Relation Ship is a man-made concept of proximities. It is an effort to give expression to the interval mental or physical by which things are separated, for relationship is not estimated by the proximity of one part to another but rather by the distance one part is away from another. Through believing that by the concept of relationship he unites life, man's efforts in this respect all too often contain only the sense of increasing separateness, for when we take that which is already synonymous with ourselves and related to ourselves, we are really dividing it from ourselves. Discrimination finally reveals to us that relationships are illusions of the mortal mind and that since all things are one in essence, they are consequently indivisible and incapable of existing in any relationship of proximity one to the other. Even the ideal of friendship, though the loftiest of man's illusional attitudes, is thus revealed as insufficient. But even as wisdom is merely the vanishing point of ignorance, so illusion exists in a state of orderly concatenation, with friendship as the last, and consequently the least degree of the illusion of relationship. 138 Lectures ONANCIENTPHILOSOPHY. Having through discrimination attained to a state of right mindfulness, it is necessary to maintain such state and project it to perfection through the aid of concentration. Having discovered the purpose of life through observation and discrimination, man consummates that purpose through concentration of his faculties upon that single end. To concentrate means simply to focalize all the energies upon an appointed task. The mental activities of most people are scattered like spray when they are confronted by the solid wall of that which is to be known. Individuals read books while their minds are concerned with other interests. When the intellect is laden with responsibility, ties which it cannot cast off, it ceases to function with the acuteness necessary for philosophic perception. The true thinker realizes that his mind is capable of fatigue, and while this fatigue may not be apparent in the grosser activities, it precludes the possibility of exactness in fine thinking. The normal mind works on the union basis of an 8-hour day, with time and a half off for overtime. For every period of intense effort, the mind must be compensated by a similar period of relaxation. The immature intellect of the average person must work slowly and orderly if it is to accomplish, for only a genius such as Julius Caesar can do a dozen things at once with any degree of success. It may truthfully be said that half an hour of profound mental activity is a day's work for the mind, and he who accomplishes this is entitled to be termed industrious in things of the intellect. We presume ourselves to be mentally active during the entire period of wakefulness, but in reality we wander in a sort of mental delirium in which the elements of conception and reflection tumble over each other in hopeless disorder. Only when confronted by some actual crisis does the mind rise to organized activity, and after the crisis is past, the resultant mental exhaustion is far greater than the average person realizes. About 15 minutes of unremitting mental concentration will exhaust the ordinary man. Only by special training can the intellectual faculties be elevated to the stage of prolonged, orderly functioning. As exercise scientifically chosen will strengthen an otherwise deficient physical member, so